DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. Sugar and spice and all things nice. Can chocolates, sweets and sugary snacks ever be healthy? Can eating junk food now affect your children in the future? And back from the brink, we hear from a scientist who has just discovered a new population of the world's rarest fish. All that and more coming up on this jam-packed edition of Spectrum. You are what you eat is not just an expression. Recent studies show that what you put into your mouth now not only affects you, but it can have flow-on effects for your children and grandchildren. Now, researchers at the University of Bonn have discovered that a Western diet, one rich in refined sugars, salt and saturated fat, is playing havoc with our immune systems. Joining me in the studio is lead researcher, Professor Eike Lutz from the University of Bonn. Professor Lutz, welcome to the program. Now, as part of your research, you fed mice the equivalent of a Western diet, one rich in refined sugars, salt, and saturated fats. So no fresh fruit or vegetables. What were you able to see?
Well, this type of diet is what we call inflammatory. So it causes an inflammation in mice and also in humans. But we use the model system mice for the reason it's easier to do. What we see after the first few days, the mice are getting a little sick. They're getting something that you would get if you have an infection. So you can see that the blood cells start to grow in a certain direction. So the bone marrow makes more monocytes and neutrophils. These are immune cells. And you see a lot of cytokines. These are mediators that immune cells make to alert other immune cells that there's something going on. So it looked like an infection to the immune system.
So I brought in a packet of chips into the studio today, and I can see you're frowning at me. Say I were to consume a whole packet of chips by myself, just how damaging are a packet of chips or even a chocolate bar? How bad are they for our health?
It's not bad if you do it not constantly. So I think what we find in humans is that you get low-grade inflammation. So you wouldn't, you know, trigger like a fever or something like that, but that said, I've had emails from people that read our study and they said, look, every time I eat a pizza, I get a fever. So there are people that actually respond to these types of diets in a more vicious way. But the average person would not respond like that. But you would get low-grade inflammation. And it's probably a process that the more you eat of the wrong diet, the more you get this type of low-grade inflammation, which is harmful in the long run.
So I probably should give up the packet of chips and the chocolate and the bottles of Coke.
Yes, you should.
Right, I'm going to put them away. Would there be any change in our bodies if we stopped eating a diet rich in sugars, salt, saturated fats, and replaced it with a healthy one? Would our bodies go back to the way they once were?
What we found is that the dietary changes to regular diet, in the mouse it's called the Chow diet, which is more a grainy-based or grain-based diet, led to changes, but it took a long time for the immune system to calm down. In fact, even after 4 weeks of a dietary change, we could see still activated immune cells sitting in the body in all kinds of places and waiting for potential other triggers like infections. So I think that this is a modulatory process. You can turn it on, and it will take a little longer to resume to the old immune system that it was before the dietary intervention.
Do our genes remember these problems that they have had with inflammation, or is it completely forgotten?
Yes, exactly. So I think what happens here is something that is very archaic. So the immune system is very trained to fight infections, viruses, bacteria, funguses. In fact, that is what people died of 150 years ago, right? And nowadays, infections are not the main cause of death anymore. But in this case, the Western diet is perceived by the immune system as an infection. And the same problems that infections could cause can also be caused by this type of inflammatory diet. So the process is really like a sort of a memory process that is turned on. And it probably has evolved to fight infections after a first infection, fight another infection in a better way. But in this case, it's probably harmful.
Is there any indication that what I eat now might, my children or my grandchildren might suffer from that in future?
Yeah, good point. So we're actually studying this. So we have, again, in a mouse system, we have frozen down the sperm of the fathers that had this Western type diet. And also the fathers that had first Western type diet and then rested on a regular Cho diet. And we want to make new mice out of the sperm and study their immune system and see whether the grandfather or the father that has had the wrong diet, whether this is transmitted, because there are indications from other areas, for example, in diabetes, that these types of what we call epigenetic changes can also be transmitted to the second or even the third generation.
So people who have inflammation in their bodies due to other illnesses, is this going to be exacerbated by the Western diet?
Yeah, so we know from medical studies that diets can have an impact on inflammation of other diseases or in other diseases. So, for example, rheumatoid arthritis patients, they know when they had the sinful diet, if I say so, because they do worse in the day and the following day or the following week. So this is known, but it's not really known what the cause might be. So we studied these types of dietary changes in the immune system for this aspect.
You've mentioned the mice and your plans for them in terms of your research, but where else is your research going now?
Well, we touched on it a little bit already, so we're looking into the next generation. We also try to repair the damage that a Western diet can do in the immune system by applying more beneficial diets, such as Mediterranean diets, which have ingredients that are actually beneficial for us. And we can also change the composition of the Western diet to see whether we find better versions of it that are not so detrimental. And also we're very interested in the mechanisms that drive these types of diseases. I mean, in the long run, what we want to do with this is to influence people's, thinking and maybe behavior. It's very hard. It's hard to fight these companies just because, the lobby is so strong, and all we can do is we can educate people about the risks.
I think you've made me rethink my diet and what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. Professor Lutz from the University of Bonn, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
As Germans start to embrace healthy living, with meat, alcohol and sugar consumption on the decline, vegetarianism and veganism are taking off. From imitation currywurst to dark chocolate nut bars, the country's supermarket shelves and restaurants are experiencing a renaissance when it comes to food. The sweets and candy fair in Cologne hasn't been immune to these changes, with interest shifting from foods with additives to cereal bars and savoury snacks. Silfa Karabani hit the ISM to find out if vegan cookies and vegetarian wine gums are as good as God.
It's got to be one of the toughest jobs to make candy and snacks for the discerning consumer in 2018. The list of ingredients that food producers insist they don't use is so long, it's a wonder the packaging doesn't say may contain traces of food. No added sugars, no added colorants, no added flavors, no added aromas, no preservatives, gluten-free, no salt, 100% vegan, 1000% vegetarian, totally tasteless. Yummy.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult, and especially as also for the consumer, it's such a maze to find a product which is right for you.
That's Rob de Wurt, the founder of the Dutch company Fruit Funk.
So I think as an industry, you have a huge responsibility also to communicate fair on a packing. And what I see nowadays that there are a lot of claims made on packing, which are, they're not fake, they're true. But if they are real, they can really not match the expectation on the of the product itself.
I would have thought companies were getting close to overdoing their labelling with all the bad things they claim to leave out. De Wurt suggests there's a difference, though, between the front and the back of packaging.
Now, on the back of the packaging, you cannot lie, of course.
So if they say gluten-free or nut-free, then you're saying, how can you say that on the one side and flip it and then, on the other hand, there are some nuts?
You've gluten-free and then but packed in an environment where gluten may fly around, you know?
These claims may not be fake, says de Wurt. They are true, but if they're real, then they can't really live up to our expectations of a product, he says. So what are our expectations? Haven't we lost sight of the fact that sweets, candy, chocolates and other fruity snacks are all unnecessary additives? They are an indulgence by definition. If you eat 3 solid meals a day, including the recommended portions of fresh fruit and vegetables, chances are you won't need any packaged goods at all. And that whole issue of what's true on packaging is solved. Or is it? Take a company like Italy's Loacca. They've been making sweet wafers and other creamy, chocolatey delights for almost 100 years. Yes, they have had to adapt to changing tastes, and that includes using as little sugar as possible. But ultimately, they make indulgence products. And do they offer any health benefits? It seems the fairest answer is the indulgence itself. After all, indulgence in sugary products releases endorphins, so the happiness you score from sweets has got to be a chief health benefit. Here's Loacca's Yvonne Profanta.
Happiness is a very important thing in the overall mental balance of people. So yes, we definitely want to make people happy by creating indulgence, but we do not use anything that is really bad. So we do not use hydrogenated fats. We are absolute believers of not putting any aromas, whether that's artificial or natural. We only have the flavor out of our of the actual variety that gives a taste to each product. And there is no added colorant or conservant whatsoever. So it really is trying to give taste and indulgence, but, you know, trying to put out everything that is potentially bad for your health or for the wholesomeness of the product.
Hydrogenated fats are a trans fat and generally regarded or recognized as unhealthy. So it's an easy one to exclude and as such a rather handy health claim. But that's as far as health claims go. In fact, European regulation makes it very hard to make any health claims in the positive. So producers are almost always restricted to claiming positives by what they omit. No sugar, no certification. In some cases, it's impossible to claim your product contains no added sugar. For instance, sugar is a must in marzipan. Without it, your health claim would read marzipan free. The Niederegger company says it always aims to use more almonds than sugar in its marzipan. But this being Germany, there are guidelines, says Katrin Gerbel.
But in general, if you like to produce marzipan, you need sugar inside, so it wouldn't be tasty at all, and you can't replace it anyway. When you think there are some guidelines when you would like to produce marzipan and call the product at the end marzipan to sell it, you are not allowed to add less sugar than we do right now. So 1/3 of sugar always has to be inside the product which you like to name marzipan.
Sugar helps bind ingredients and it creates volume in a product. Over on the savoury side of the snacks, you could indulge in fried cod skin chips from IC Core, a company from Iceland. The cod is fished locally, of course. If you want cod, come to Iceland, says the company. But there aren't many takers, strangely, in the domestic market. Perhaps they're missing out on all those health benefits. IC Core's Jana Kachuk says their product is 60% protein, so it's very healthy, and you won't find as much protein in any meat, she says. I wonder how German company Kraftfleisch feels about that. Their jerky is low-carb, high-protein, paleo-suitable and rendered from grass-fed cattle. I'm sure their product is packed with protein, judging from the monochrome muscly men on their website. The image is so tough you can almost smell the smoke through the packaging and your computer screen, of course. But their train hard, eat power slogan does nothing for the sit soft, eat chocolate type like me. Or types like Joshua Schupp, a food scientist and quality and innovation manager at the candy store from the Netherlands. By Schupp's own unprovoked admission, he is obese. He should be unhealthy and officially that, and on speed dial for diabetes. But four doctors have assured him he is healthy. For now, at least, of course. Perhaps that has something to do with all the chocolate he eats. Up to a kilo a day, mind you.
What is it about cocoa? What's so nutritionally important or good for people?
Oh, yeah, if you look at it nutritionally wise, it's really, really good for you. It contains a lot of fibers. People forget that fibers is a really strong thing to boost your immune system. And it has a lot of vitamins and also some minerals. So it is quite healthy for you if you look at it only from the positive side. Of course, a lot of fat in cocoa incorporated. And I mean only the cocoa, so not the chocolate, because chocolate also consists sugar. And sugar is, of course, never healthy for you.
The higher the cocoa content in chocolate, the healthier it is said to be. Or, let's be a little safer in our claim here, the less damaging it is to your health. That's not least because there's less sugar, but also because the cocoa solids contain what Schupp calls the nutrients that are beneficial for your health, such as the antioxidants, polyphenols, minerals, vitamins, and fibres. But again, that doesn't mean that overdosing on cocoa is a good idea. For a start, 100% cocoa is unpalatable, says Schupp. But whether you're going backwards or forwards or just staying put on your comfy sofa, what you put into your body really is your responsibility, no matter how fair or transparent the labelling on packaging is. You must take responsibility for what you eat yourself. And that is the message that comes from the ISM, the sweets and candy fair in Cologne. If you want to eat sweets, be mindful that you're eating sweets. Indulge away, but do that in moderation or risk the consequences.
Sulfa Karabani reporting there from the sweets and candy fair in Cologne, Germany. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Jesse Wingard on DW. Madeline Vergara Hernandez from Colombia, who has written into us here at the Science Desk with a question, wants to know, is it possible to weigh clouds? Natalie Muller is here with the answer. Natalie, over to you.
Well, you certainly can't put them on a set of scales, but you can still work out how much they weigh by solving two physics-related questions. First, what's the cloud's volume? The answer to that is its length multiplied by its breadth times the height. Data like that can be gathered by radar satellites orbiting the Earth. Question two is, how much water does the cloud contain? Clouds are condensed water vapour, so water content determines the weight of a cloud. Another task for the satellites, they can measure the water content of a single cubic metre of cloud. Multiply that by the cloud's volume and you have the total weight. That reveals that one single cloud can weigh thousands of tons. Fair weather clouds may seem to float weightlessly across the sky, and airplanes can fly through them without any major resistance, but they have an enormous mass. Dark rain clouds are really heavy, up to 7 times heavier than the more common lighter variety. That's because they contain up to 7 times as much water. And over tropical humid oceans, clouds form that contain truly vast amounts of water, and sooner or later, the air in them grows so saturated that things get very wet down below.
If you've got a question you'd like us to answer at the Science Desk, get in contact with us via email science@dw.com, Twitter @dw_scitech, Facebook @dwscience, or you can always write to me on Twitter @JesseWingard. Girl, let me hold ya, put The old saying goes, there are plenty of fish in the sea, but that's not quite true for the red handfish. Scientists from the University of Tasmania in Australia have stumbled on what could possibly be the world's rarest fish. Choosing to walk on fins rather than swim, the red handfish population was thought to have only numbered around 20 fish. With me to talk about the find is University of Tasmania researcher and co-founder of Reef Life Survey, Dr. Rick Stewart-Smith. Dr. Stewart-Smith, welcome to the program. This has got to be one of the coolest looking fish going around. Now, for anybody who hasn't seen photos of the red handfish, can you describe what they look like?
Yeah, very unusual. They certainly have captured the public's attention, and I think it's been great to see so much interest in fish for once. They're very small. Most of the ones we see are between 6 and 9 centimetres, and they live on the bottom, and they have modified fins that are like hands, so they basically walk along the bottom. They don't actually do much. They sit there quite still most of the time, but when they move, they walk on their fins rather than swimming. So they're quite variable in appearance. Some of them are really bright red and some of them are quite dull orangey colour and have sort of some spots and sort of warty appearance. And they also have a little lure that they, like an anglerfish, that is on the end of a stem that they can tuck back most of the time. But yeah, they're very distinctive and interesting looking fish.
Now, this has to be one of the rarest fish in the world. What made you start looking where you did for the red handfish?
Basically, there's 3 species of handfish that are listed as endangered, and one of them lives on the soft sediment in the Derwent right at Hobart's doorstep, and that's been reasonably well researched. But the red handfish used to be scattered around southeastern Tasmania and was quite common back in the 80s. And it just started disappearing rapidly from all of those locations. And for about the last 15 years, there's only been one particular location it's been known from. And it's just one tiny patch of reef about 50 metres long. And so with the Reef Life Survey program, we've actually been going back searching. Probably for the last 7 years, we've been searching all of the places that it's previously been known from. Been spending lots of time underwater with lots of divers and haven't found it anywhere else other than this one patch of reef. And we haven't even known how many there were on that patch of reef, because you only ever see 1 or 2 individuals each year that you monitor it. So we haven't had enough data to get a population estimate, basically. But this year we went back and there was pretty sparse seaweed cover. So they live on the rocky reef, tucked right under the seaweed. So you have to lift each piece of seaweed one by one to find them. And so you're searching for a long time. And this one patch of reef this year had not much seaweed cover, and we were able to find 8. And based on a few rough calculations, we estimated there to be 20 to 40 individuals. And so that was the entire known population of this species in the world, which makes it incredibly rare. But we also had a tip from a member of the public about a sighting somewhere else. So we followed that up, and we spent a lot of time diving at this other location. I think it was a three and a half hour dive in very shallow water, and with 7 divers. And we found one, and then we searched the area because we know that they live close to each other at the other location, and found another 7 individuals. So basically, it's another patch of individuals similar size to the other. So it pretty much doubles the known or the expected population size of this species, which is, was a huge relief, given that each time we saw one in the past, we never knew if it was going to be the last one that would ever be seen. So, it was a big relief.
What new information do you think you'll be able to get from this find to help with the recovery effort and to increase the population?
The possibility for captive breeding, there's an better understanding of the habitat and, the sort of size of the area they inhabit per individual. Plus, there's the new hope that there's more population still out there. And I think we've put out a call to the Australian public, to the Tasmanian public, and we've already had a few potential sightings of them elsewhere, which we're going to investigate. But we've also had some sightings from Martinique and Philippines and places where they're most definitely not. So, it's hard to know which are the reliable, credible sightings and not. But we'll certainly investigate the ones that seem most credible, and hopefully we'll find some more populations now.
Well, here's hoping. Dr. Rick Stewart-Smith, a researcher at the University of Tasmania and co-founder of Reef Life Survey, congratulations on your find, and thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
You're welcome, Jesse.
Together, We Are Less Alone is the name of a French novel where not everyone who is alone is lonely. Now, Britain has launched its first campaign to combat loneliness and social isolation. Prime Minister Theresa May has promised practical and emotional support for the elderly, carers and young disabled people. The head of Age UK, Mark Robinson, said following the announcement that loneliness can kill and it's proven to be worse for health than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Now, other European countries are discussing similar schemes and how to combat the problem. From Stockholm, Sweden, Carsten Schmiester sent this report, which is presented by Andreas Becker.
There are various ways of combating bulabuitis, or a case of overwrought rapture about Swedish life. For one, just live here longer. See how everyday life looks beyond the sunny summer weeks, which are often romanticized in Germany. It gets very cold, if not necessarily as dark as described in the Nordic noir thrillers. Further insight comes from the documentary The Swedish Theory of Love, which is dedicated to a problem faced by Swedish society, Ensamhet, or loneliness. It's not only the Brits and Germans who struggle with it, says Eric Gandini, who made the film and who considers Britain's recent announcement of a ministry against loneliness to be anything but a gag a la Monty Python.
We have to finally admit that we too have a problem with this in Sweden, which is why I am happy to hear about England's initiative. The topic has been taboo up to now. It was something people should be ashamed of.
While the superficial picture of Sweden almost exclusively depicts people who can get along by themselves in the most magnificent of nature, who are always friendly to others but also keep a considerate distance, Gandini and social researchers see the matter less positively. Yes, Sweden is indeed a country of longing, they say. People long for warmth, but they're longing for a warmth that even the summer sun doesn't deliver.
When you look at the statistics, Sweden's in fourth place when it comes to consumption of antidepressants. 1.8 million Swedes are taking psychotropic drugs. One in four people die alone. And Sweden has the highest percentage of people living alone in the world. So we can't just act as if there's no need to talk about it.
For example, you could simply question the societal idea of the Social Democrats from the 1970s. What has become of that idea is that nobody should be dependent on others. This model is now deeply rooted, says Philip Fors, a happiness researcher at the University of Umeå, and he believes that that is one of the causes of the widespread loneliness in the far north.
In Scandinavian countries, there is a long tradition of people wanting to be independent from relatives and family. That is a different attitude than in most of the rest of the world.
This leads to the negative consequences that hundreds of thousands of Swedes experience, and filmmaker Gandini wants people to finally talk about it. The topic is now tentatively being discussed, at least in the media, but whether this really changes anything seems questionable, because according to happiness researcher Fors, things actually aren't that bad in Sweden. Sure, they are world leaders in living alone, have a high divorce rate and see every human being as an island, as the saying goes, but...
You can look at other values, which in my opinion better measure loneliness. How often do you meet relatives, whether you have a close friend with whom you can discuss personal matters, and above all, if you feel lonely.
Carsten Schmiester sent us that report from Stockholm, Sweden, which was presented by Andreas Becker. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spectrum. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of the show. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world. Check us out on Twitter at @DW_SciTech, and we're also online, dw.com/science. I'm Jessie Wingard. On Twitter, you can find me at Jessie Wingard, and I'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.